Welcome to Curious Campus, a discussion about science, discovery, and culture, brought to you by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I'm your host, Tom Lujack. In the wild, frog romance is a raucous affair. When it's time to mate, the female eastern gray tree frog makes her way to the pond, where there could be hundreds of potential suitors, each calling to her in loud chirps that have different audible characteristics. In this chorus we just heard, the male aims to charm the female with his particular call. But what makes a call attractive? On today's program, we're talking with two researchers who specialize in amphibian communication, how frogs message each other and then decide how to respond. Gerlinda Herbel is an associate professor of biological sciences at UWM's College of Letters and Science, and Michael Reichert is an assistant professor of integrative biology in the College of Arts and Sciences at Oklahoma State University. Gerlinda and Michael, welcome to Curious Campus. So good to have both of you with us today.
Thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Gerlinda, let's begin with you. Tell us a little bit about vocal communication among this species of frogs we're talking about today.
Yeah, so today we're talking about mostly gray tree frogs, which is a local species that is quite common around Milwaukee and Wisconsin. And these guys meet up during the breeding season, which is coming up pretty soon once it gets a little warmer. And the males gather in choruses and they start calling for many, many nights, many, many hours. And they produce mostly what is called an advertisement call, which sometimes people also call a mating call, because that call mainly functions to attract females. That's how males tell the females, I'm over here, I'm really interesting, you should come over. And the females have an interesting behavior because females don't wait for males to come over. It's actually the females that when they like a call that sounds good to them, they will actually hop over to the male and then initiate mating themselves. And so males give those advertisement calls. Mostly it's for females, but also it tells other males, hey, this is my calling territory. You should better not stick around here. And if other males don't pay attention and they come too close, then they actually have a second type of call, which is called an aggressive call. That's how they basically negotiate those social interactions that they have to deal with if they want to find a mate in that kind of big, complex environment that constitutes a chorus.
Well, let's listen to two of those different kinds of calls. Again, this is the eastern gray tree frog. So, Gerlinda, can you talk about what we just heard and the differences between the two?
So what we just heard, the first two calls were the advertisement calls of a very attractive male that had a call of about 25 pulses. So that's something that females find very, very interesting. And then that second clip, that short call, that was also an advertisement call. However, that was of a really unattractive male. That was only about half as long as that first call that you could probably see there. No.
Well, every spring, Gerlinda and Michael, both of you and your students test how females react to male mating calls. So I wanted to talk about that. Let's set up the tree frog mating game for us. As the female approaches the pond, what does she hear and what are those conditions? Michael?
Yeah, so as she's coming to the pond, basically, this pond contains a large number of males all calling very close together. So it's very, very dense and very loud for that reason. And when you're far away from the chorus, it's basically just a wall of sound. You just hear this noise in the background and you get closer and closer and it gets louder and louder. And the challenge for the female is that she has to find a single male to mate with in all of that noise. And so it's incredibly loud. It's very chaotic. Very complex in terms of the number of males that are calling, and her job is to actually find the male that she prefers to mate with, which is not an easy thing when it's that loud. There could be actually hundreds of males out there calling on a good night, and so this is quite a challenge to try to distinguish between them and try to find the male that she's most interested in mating with. And we know that females have very strong preferences for certain types of call characteristics. And so one of our challenges is to try to understand why they have these preferences and also how they actually manage to then find these mates within that very noisy, very chaotic chorus.
So, Gerlinda, what are the characteristics of the male call?
So, in our great tree frogs, we know that there's basically two main things that the females are interested in. One is call duration, which is how long the call is or how many pulses are kind of strung together to make that call. So that's really kind of the main thing. And then also how often that call is repeated. Females like it better if there's many, many calls in a short amount of time than if there's like the occasional call now and then. For some species, pitch is important, the frequency of the call. But it turns out for our great tree frogs, it's kind of the third on the list. If everything else fails, maybe they go for pitch differences. But mostly it's the call duration that they really, really like.
So why is the competition so fierce? Michael?
Basically, you think about the pond, it's going to have maybe dozens or even hundreds of males out there, and there's only a few females. And so a few females will come each night. And so all of those males are basically competing for a very small number of females. And this is very important because this determines whether those males are able to actually find a mate or not. And if they are able to attract a female, then they're very successful in terms of passing along their genes to the next generation. And if they don't, then they're out of luck. And so most females are only going to mate once per summer, but the males could be out there pretty much every night trying to attract a female. And so for that reason, there's going to be a lot of competition between those males for those few females that are there.
Why are there so fewer females? Is it that they're not out there, or are they just away awaiting their time before the chorus sings to them?
Yeah. So female frogs generally only come to the pond to the chorus when they're ready to mate. So when they already have a clutch formed. And forming a clutch, which can consist of hundreds or thousands of eggs, that costs a lot of energy. So it's really, really hard to do. So many females may only kind of gather up the energy to produce a clutch once a year, maybe only once a lifetime, because it's so hard. And many of them also just don't live very long. We did a study in our population, and most of our breeding females are 1 year old. Occasionally, they get to 2 or 3 year old. And then they probably get eaten.
Oh.
because frogs,
that's so sad.
Frogs are a very important, they're very important in the food chain, and they're just an important component of the food of other organisms out there, you know?
Wow. Well, Michael, the frogs, of course, can't tell us what they like. So how do you, as a scientist, figure out what their preferences are?
So it would be nice if we could follow them in the wild and kind of observe them as they're moving through the chorus and choosing mates. But this is actually very difficult. And one reason for that is just that the pond is, of course, very dark because it's at night that all of this is happening. And these are very small frogs. And so it's actually quite hard to track a female as she's making those choices. So instead, what we do is we actually take the female from the pond and bring her back to the lab onto campus. And we have a very large chamber, kind of a arena for these frogs that we actually use to test her preferences. And so basically, you can kind of imagine a walk-in freezer or something like that. It's got this very large insulated shell, and that's good for the acoustics. And so we get very good acoustic conditions inside of that room. And then we can also control other things like the temperature and so on. And that allows us to then test these females in very nice conditions. And so basically, we put the female inside of this chamber, and we have an arena in there that's circular. It's about 6 feet wide, and we have speakers on the edge of the arena. And what we can then do is play frog calls through those speakers and observe how the female moves towards those speakers to make her choice. And we can actually generate frog calls using a computer program, so we can make artificial frog calls that allow us to very precisely control the characteristics of the calls that we're trying to study.
Wow. Gerlinde, so walk us in more detail now into that frog arena that you've created. What does that experiment involve, picking up where Michael left off?
So it depends there's two ways we do our tests. Sometimes we have two speakers in there, and then we give the female a choice between two different calls. And we just watch, is she going to go to one? Is she going to go to the other? Are more females going to the one? That gives us a good idea that on a population basis, this is a type of call that females really like. If they go 50-50, then it's like, well, seems not to be such an important difference in the calls. So that's a two-choice paradigm. And sometimes we also just give females a series of calls in sequence that differ just a little bit. It's always just one call, but they differ a little bit. And then we basically ask her, how do you like this one? Okay, next questionnaire. If we tweak something like that, how do you like this one? How do you like this one? And then depending how quickly she walks over to the speaker, that's a kind of an indication for us how much she liked that specific call alternative. And then we can kind of make what we call preference functions, which is kind of a graphical display of showing, given the variation in the male call, that is the relative attractiveness that the female gives to them. And that way we can figure out sometimes there are individual females that really like long calls. Sometimes there are individual females that are actually like short calls. And sometimes there are females that really don't have any preference at all.
That's fascinating. What happens when the female frog walks over to the speaker, because they're listening to this computer-generated sound, and discover that there's no male frog there? Are they confused?
They're quite confused. They sit in front of it, and sometimes I've seen them, you know, even kind of touch the speaker and try to figure out, is there a male behind it maybe or something? So it's I've watched thousands and thousands of playback trials in my life, and I still, every time I get a chance, I have to watch it. It's just so cute how they just like listen and then walk over there. It's like, oh, there's the male I want to mate with. Where are you?
Where are you? You're hiding behind there, right?
Where are you?
Come on out. Michael, when you're doing these experiments, what are the kinds of questions that you're trying to investigate in this arena that you've created?
Well, what's nice about these arenas is that there's kind of infinite possibilities. So you can add in as much complexity as you want. And part of what we're doing is now trying to add in some of this realistic features of the course back into the arena. So the arena is very simple compared to a natural pond, of course, but we want to try to investigate some of those other characteristics. So for example, one thing that I'm going to be doing this summer is looking at what happens when you have this second type of vocalization, an aggressive call, also being played at the same time as these advertisement calls. And perhaps that would affect females' choices. Maybe, for example, they don't want to go near the aggressive call. Other things we like to do are kind of make the female's decision a little bit harder. And so there's many ways to do that, but one way is to add in some noise in the background. So this is, of course, a natural situation. They're making these choices in background noise. And so we look to see if that affects their decision, maybe if it's a bit tougher to hear those calls over the noise, or we maybe give her a more difficult choice between, say, an attractive call that's nearby or an unattractive call. Excuse me, I said that backwards. An attractive call that's far away versus an unattractive call that's nearby. And so now you've got sort of a trade-off there. And the question is, how does the female weight those decisions? Does she choose something that's closer, maybe not as attractive, or something that's further away, but much more attractive?
Do either of you find yourselves surprised at the behavior of some of the frogs, or is the behavior pretty much consistent regardless of what year you're doing it and which frog you have in this little test stage that you've created, Gerlinde?
So I'm continuously surprised, because every time you get an answer for one experiment or one question, a whole bunch of others pop up. And so for a long time, all I was interested in was population preferences. Just, you know, looking at the population as a whole, what are the preferences? And now more and more we look starting to look at individual female preferences. And we're really surprised how variable those are. Even for things like call duration, where we were really sure long calls, that's what it's at. And now it turns out, well, there's a sizable minority of females that actually don't think long calls are so hot, or especially with the quickly repeated calls. We actually have some females, almost actually half the population, it looks like, that actually think that really fast calls are really ugly. They really don't like it. But others really love it. And so on a population basis, if you average it out, it looks like there's a slight preference for fast calls. But if you look at the individual females, you basically have ones that like complete opposites. And I was blown away when I saw that data.
Are both of you have spent much of your career looking at frog behavior, at the way in which they communicate. Could you talk a little bit about what the meaning of your research is in terms of understanding the animal world and how these creatures are different or maybe not so different from the way that we communicate? Do you think about those questions, Michael?
Absolutely. First of all, I mean, I would just say that everything mates and pretty much every animal communicates somehow or another. And so what we're using is a species that happens to have some very useful properties for studying communication. They're easy to find. They have fairly simple signals and they have this fairly simple behavior. But as Gerlinda pointed out earlier, it's actually much more complex than we think. And so the more we delve into it, the more deeply we can understand some very interesting aspects about animal behavior and communication. And certainly this relates to human communication. I mean, we use a lot of acoustic signals, and actually a lot of the challenges that we face in acoustic communication are the same that the frogs face. For example, trying to follow a voice in a crowded room or something like that is much the same challenge as trying to find a mate in a very busy chorus.
Mm-hmm. Gerlinda, how about you? Lessons that you take from your studies of frogs as you do this research and apply it to either other species or perhaps even to the way humans behave.
Yeah, I mean, especially kind of things that have to do with like how can a female pick out just one male in this craziness of a chorus? How is communication possible if there's a lot of interaction between and overlap between different calls? Those are things that when I research them, they're quite interesting in terms of how can we extrapolate from an simple animal to something that's more complex communication. But also, a lot of those communication signals, especially the more obvious one or the more noticeable ones, like the mating calls, yeah, or the crazy dances or the songs of birds or stuff like that. Those are all, they're linked to communication, but they're also, because they're used for mate choice, they're also linked to sexual selection. And so that's kind of basically what we're also studying, is like how can we explain that there's all this beautiful diversity out there? How can different species come about? That's all ultimately kind of linked to the type of communication that is involved in choosing a mate.
Truly is part of the wonder of the natural world that we live in, isn't it? You're listening to Curious Campus, a discussion about science, discovery, and culture, brought to you by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I'm your host, Tom Lujak. Our guests today are Gerlinda Herbel, an associate professor in biological sciences at UWM's College of Letters and Science, and Michael Reichert, an assistant professor of integrative biology in the College of Arts and Sciences at Oklahoma State University. Michael and Gerlinda, I would love to hear your backstory. What is it that attracted both of you to this field of study? Again, it's so fascinating. You spend so much time in this one area. What is it that brought you here in the first place, Gerlinda?
I've always been really interested in nature, and during my high school, during the last year of my high school, I had to do like an independent study project. And my teacher, because I didn't really know what I should do, my teacher told me, okay, there's this area around a lake. I think frogs breed there. Why don't you do a survey over there? And I did that. And I became totally fascinated by frogs. and have taken every opportunity since to kind of study them more. So when I went to university, my university in Ulm had an exchange program with Costa Rica. So I got the opportunity to go see frogs, study frogs in the tropical rainforest. And I got the chance to go back there to do my master thesis. I, you know, took it and just ran with it.
Right place, right time, and frogs were in the middle
and,
of it.
And
right?
They were in the middle, yeah. And but it was also, it was really before that last year of high school, I just liked animals. I didn't really, you know, have anything special. And then afterwards, I became really focused on frogs. And then I started to read scientific papers. And then it was like, wow, and they have these really cool calls. And you can do manipulative experiments with them. And you can test their preferences. And then, yeah, it just kind of developed from there.
How about you, Michael? Did you, was it a trip to the rainforest that triggered your interest in frogs?
Well, I was certainly always interested in the rainforest, but didn't have a chance to get there before I found frogs. But my story is actually quite similar to Gerlinde. So I was always very interested in nature. I loved the animals in general. I loved the idea of going to zoos and seeing animals, going out into nature and seeing animals. We had actually a good bit of land when I was growing up, so I was able to get out and explore that land as a kid. And that really certainly cemented my love of nature. And I don't think I really knew what I wanted to do with that exactly until partway through college, and just happened to see an advertisement for someone who was looking for a student to assist them for the summer working on their project on frog behavior. And I just thought that sounded really cool to get paid to do something like that. And so I applied for that and was lucky enough to get it. And actually, it turns out that they were working on calling behavior in gray tree frogs, which is still what I do. So I just really fell for it. I just enjoyed that so much, found it fascinating to go out there and see this behavior. And then once I learned about the scientific questions, then I was just hooked on that as well. And so I've pursued that ever since.
So Michael, you're at the Oklahoma State University, Gerlinde, UW-Milwaukee. How did the two of you connect?
The scientific world sometimes is pretty small. We had the same PhD advisor. After I did my master's in Germany, where I was in a lab that allowed me to pursue my interests in frog communication, but I was the only person there that did anything even remotely similar. And so for my PhD, I really knew I wanted to go to a place where everybody kind of had the same interest that I had. And that brought me to Missouri, to the lab of Carl Gerhard. And then Michael was a PhD student there too, but we didn't overlap, right? I don't think so.
No.
So I had already moved on, but then when I had the opportunity at UWM to get a postdoc over, I invited Michael to come join me in my lab and work with me for a while.
What a great great connection! Frogs, right, again, bringing the two researchers together for something that you love to do.
Yeah. And he came pre-trained. It was perfect.
Okay, let's get back to the frog mating calls. So, Michael, knowing that there's such different preferences for these calls, what's the significance of that as you're studying these in your research?
Well, that's very important because if different females have different preferences, then potentially they're going to choose different mates. And all of this ultimately affects whether an individual male is able to reproduce or not, depending on whether he gets a mate or not. And so if different females have different preferences, it essentially kind of spreads out the males who are going to be mated with. It's not all going to be the one most attractive male that every female prefers. Instead, it's going to be maybe different females choosing different mates. And that's going to really affect which individuals then are successful in this process of sexual selection, kind of successful in terms of attracting a mate and then being able to pass on those traits to their offspring.
So it means that we shouldn't categorize a species thinking that all frogs of one species are the same. There's lots of variation, lots of differences within these hundreds or maybe even sometimes thousands that are gathered around a pool. Correct, Michael?
Exactly. And that may be surprising because you might think that frogs should be simple. They should all just have the same preference. And we did think like that for quite a long time. I mean, if you read some of the old scientific papers, they will describe just the average preference of a species or something like that. But that's, as we're now learning, not necessarily correct because different individuals prefer different things. And one other thing that's worth pointing out is that even if they have preferences for certain characteristics of calls, they might still end up mating with somebody else that does not necessarily meet those preferences, in part because it's so loud and so complex out there that they might simply end up mating with a different male, or maybe their preferences, although they have one, are not that strong. And so actually they're perfectly happy to mate with some other male if that one comes along as well.
Yeah. Yeah. That's actually something that one of my grad students found out over the last couple of years. So there's, on the one hand, we can describe a female preference. So that tells us what is it she likes. But we can also describe how choosy she is. How much effort is she actually willing to put into getting what she really wants? And it turns out that preference and choosiness are not linked with each other. So there are females out there that have a really strong idea of what they want. And if the choosiness is high, she will walk across the pond to get that.
Michael, let's shift over to the idea of cognition and learning for a moment. What's the central question that your lab is working on right now?
So one thing we're very interested in is kind of looking a little bit deeper into these females' decisions and trying to understand how their brain is processing these sounds. Because, of course, to make a decision, they have to hear the sound, and then somehow that is processed by the brain and determines whether the female then moves towards that call or not. And we're looking at this from a couple of different angles, but one thing that we're doing is trying to ask how females determine whether they're choosing a mate of the correct species. There's actually other species out there that sound sort of similar, and they can sometimes even be calling in the same pond. And it's very important, of course, for the female to mate with the correct species. If she doesn't, then sometimes their offspring are unsuccessful. Usually their offspring are unsuccessful, in fact. And so the only way she can tell this is actually through the call that the male is producing. And so essentially what we're doing is using this frog arena and giving females the choice between some kind of confusing stimuli that have parts of the call of her own species and parts of the call of another species. And we put those pieces together in different orders. And then we ask, when does a female actually respond to that call as though it's from her own species? And we're finding that depending on the ordering of these things, that determines whether she responds or not. So this actually tells us something about when this decision is being made in the brain.
So at the end of the day, how is sexual selection then related to the evolution of a species?
Yeah, sexual selection is very powerful. And what's interesting about it is it causes the evolution of traits that are somewhat different than what natural selection does. So natural selection is things that influence survival and general reproduction, but sexual selection is for attracting mates. And so very strange characteristics sometimes can be used to attract mates. And most of the things we find interesting about animals, their bright colors and very impressive tails or sounds and things like this, these are related to mate attraction. These are related to sexual selection. And all of these things evolve because they allowed individuals to be more successful at attracting mates. And there's really lots of different kinds of characteristics that are involved in mate attraction. So everywhere from possibly bigger brains, better learning, to better ability to find food, to simply being more attractive in some cases, is all very important for this mate choice.
Michael Gerlanda, fascinating conversation. Congratulations on the tremendous job that you're doing in this research. It really tells a story about a part of the world that we sometimes may hear out in the woods, or near the campfire, but not understand all that's going on in the background. And your work certainly is contributing to our understanding of that part of nature that is all around us. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, that's today's program. Thanks for listening. Our guests today were Gerlinda Herbel, an associate professor in biological sciences at UW-Milwaukee's College of Letters and Science, and Michael Reichert, an assistant professor of integrative biology at the College of Arts and Sciences at Oklahoma State University. Curious Campus is produced by Genera Armas and Laura Otto. Our engineer is Jason Reavy, and I'm your host, Tom Lujack. If you enjoyed our show, please consider subscribing on your favorite podcast app.